Heat them up.
Do. Ray.
Egon.
Tell him about the Twinkie.
What about the Twinkie?
You know, it's just occurred to me we really haven't had a completely successful test of this equipment.
I blame myself.
So do I.
Something strange in your neighborhood. Who you gonna call?
Ghostbusters! Tell you what, I'll take Miss Barrett back to her apartment and check her out. And it don't look good. I'll go check out Miss Barrett's apartment.
Now we're actually going to go before a federal judge and say that some moldy Babylonian god is going to drop in on Central Park West and start tearing up the city?
Mary, not Babylonian.
Yeah, Victor.
But accept the fact that this city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
What do you mean, biblical?
What he means is Old Testament, Mr. Mayor. Real wrath of God type stuff.
Exactly.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the skies. Rivers and seas boiling.
40 years of darkness, earthquakes, volcanoes.
The dead rising from the grave.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Right?
Oh, I didn't know you were racist.
Hello again. Good trash. GenreCast, where a UCO Film Society podcast kept going after school, and we keep talking about the good trash, not the high art, not the film studies course syllabi material. No, we're talking about the trash movies, but there's still something to be said about them. We need to do some introductions before we can get this going. To my right, sir, if you introduce yourself, please.
I am Arthur Gordon, and it is true. The man to my far left has no dick.
and our guest host tonight, to the further to the right.
Hi, I'm Nick Sanford, and I didn't go to school because I suck.
He wants to make movies.
He makes movies. He's doing
it
right.
I make movies, and I do the stand-up comedy locally.
Nick, you're back.
I'm back.
We're glad to have you back,
it's
man.
It's been almost a year. It has.
Wow.
But I finally got out of the pit, and I made it back into Oklahoma undetected. And now I'm here.
To fight Bane.
To fight, no, just you.
Just mostly. The man to my left, if you'd introduce yourself.
Well, my name is Dalton Stewart, and I was going to say what Arthur said.
Yes, it's true. This man has no dick.
So I have no fun thing this week.
That's all right.
I will say this. Every movie should have a random insert of Dan Aykroyd getting down with a ghost.
I know, right?
It's really... Really,
why not?
Out of place insert.
It's pretty fun.
It's demanded by
it might be totally in place, I might suggest.
But, well, all right then.
My name is Dustin Sells. I am the Black Ghostbuster of this crew, and I'm very happy to be with you all.
Shut up.
What? It's true. And we are glad to be looking at the movie Ghostbusters tonight. This is an analysis show.
Not a review show.
Not a review show. That means we are going to be in spoilers because we are going to do analysis. We're going to talk about what this movie means. But we will begin like a review show just to give you an idea where we're coming from. And then, dear listener, if you don't want spoilers and you need to go watch this movie, I don't know where you've been for the last 30 years.
If you haven't seen it, you're messing up.
Yeah. You're doing life wrong.
That's
but
accurate.
We are going to begin with a synopsis from the voice of the cinema. Mr. Arthur Gordon, if you would, sir.
Three unemployed parapsychology professors set up shop as a unique ghost removal service.
That's what happens, and hilarity ensues. They all get married in the end.
Yep.
We're happy about that. That's the big spoiler. Let's talk about what we always do. What we like, what we don't like about this movie. Thumbs up, thumbs down. I begin to my left. Mr. Dalton Stewart, if you would, sir.
I mean, of course it works. There's a reason this is, a comedy classic. It's a very funny film, and it does something that I don't think we see very often. There aren't a lot of set piece bits of dialogue, and what I mean by that is, and Apatow comedies, one that just kind of springs to mind is a Knocked Up, the You Know How I Know You're Gay, and it's these set piece like improv riffs.
The 40-year-old version.
Thank you, Nick. But it's these set piece improvised bits of dialogue that just kind of take on a life of their own. And in Ghostbusters, much like Clue, one of my first shows, the writing is very tight. And even when it is improvised, it feels very tight because they're almost throwaway lines of dialogue that are just so funny. Like they breeze past it like it's not a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it takes a bit of faith in the viewer on the part of the filmmaker to say, We expect you to know that this is funny. We're not going to pause for laughs, like, to signify that it's a joke for you. And I think that's really kind of brave. It's something you don't see a whole lot anymore. And it's just such a funny film. It really is. I mean, obviously, there's a reason our intro this week was nothing but Ghostbusters quotes. Because there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just a really funny film. And it works for me. I've said it before on the show. Does the comedy make me laugh? Yes. All right, it's passed the bar test. I really don't have much else criticism in terms of a comedy film.
Yeah,
that's right. Where I come from, you know.
All right, together on the table, Mr. Dick Sanford, do you like this movie?
It is one of my all-time favorite movies. In fact, a couple years ago, I got Asperger's-y, and I made a list of, like, my top 50 favorite movies in order, and Ghostbusters was in the top 20 or 25. I don't remember exactly where. But, yeah, it's my favorite comedy ever, hands down. And I like it because it has... I mean, it does have set pieces, but it has action set pieces and kind of special effects set pieces. There aren't many giant budget special effects extravaganza comedies around, like, hardly at all anymore. And if they do, it's Heaven Almighty. And yeah,
right.
But no, that's why I like Ghostbusters, is because it's kind of got this unique tone, and no movie kind of before or after has ever really kind of nailed down what it did.
It's very specific.
It's its own thing, because there are a lot of the Apatow comedies nowadays, which I'm tired of, but they're never, I don't know, just Ghostbusters is its kind of own thing.
And the effects here are still really good.
Yeah, they hold on.
And I think that we've talked about this on the show before, but I think that says something about the nature of practical effects, and obviously some of this is some rotoscoping, it isn't all practical, but it's about as analog as a special effect can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that helps in longevity in terms of how long the illusion holds up for.
Well, and even the worser looking, that's just made up for, even the not as, you know, good special effects, I mean, are still kind of even charming.
They're
like,
endearing.
You know, the demon dog
doesn't look
great. Running down the street, you know, it doesn't look as great as it used to, but even that, it just kind of has its own little charm
exactly,
to it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So.
Absolutely.
Instead of making you think, this is old, you think, this is old, but in a good way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
Well, Mr. Arthur Gordon, do you like this movie?
I actually hate this movie.
Do you?
I'm just kidding. definite thumbs up. Watching it last night.
This is about to be a weird episode.
All for all against one again.
How we all voted Arthur off the island.
That was the only way that I would have been able to let, like, you could have got me to sit next to Dalton, is if you actually hated this movie. The only way.
I'll go sit at the city gate, regardless. Watching it last night made me realize that I haven't watched this movie enough.
Right.
And this is another of those perfect storm films where the casting, writing, timing, direction, and chemistry all work beyond belief.
Yeah.
We have great performances from Rick Moranis and Ernie Hudson, while Murray Ackroyd and Ramis compete to steal the show. And I think Murray wins, hands down.
Oh.
It's his movie.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
But some of this...
Ramis gives him a run for his money. I love so many of Egon's bits. Which is so weird.
Well, it's even in that, the Do, Re, Egon.
Right.
The look he gives to them is just, it's beautiful. some of the special effects do feel dated, but they're not distracting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right, it just adds to the power and the greatness of the film.
Yeah.
It speaks to that. And there's also this level of cheesiness, which just makes this a super fun movie.
Well, for me, guys, the flowers are still standing. That's all I can say. This is a nostalgia movie for me. I mean, I had the VHS tape that I broke and bought another one and broke it too. I mean, I love this movie and always.
You want to get this one, Arthur? You want to get this one? What's a VHS? There we go.
Well, before there were.
Is this before Laserdisc?
Prior to Laserdisc and sometime after Betamax. Love this movie. I told everyone off air that Will Smith's character in I Am Legend does this thing with Shrek. I do this with this movie. I love this movie.
I think yours is a better choice.
Was that? Well, yeah, by far. It's just a great movie. It's super quotable. It's super funny. It is so much fun. It is hilarious. The special effects, they do hold up in their own kind of way. And these actors, these comedians are just, they're gold. They're absolute gold.
Top of their game.
Absolutely they are. And this is kind of their best film, the lot of them. And so that is a big part of why this movie completely works. Because, you know, you think about Rick Moranis' other work, you know. I mean,
Big Bully.
Yeah, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Canadian Bacon.
Strange Brew. Yeah, we're out on this stuff. Even Little Shop of Horrors, which I love.
Yeah.
This just pales in comparison. And you could go down the list of the rest of the actors.
I think Murray's probably the only one in terms as a comedy actor that this is not his
Well, this is his best movie.
It's his most popular movie. I wouldn't say it's his best performance.
Well, okay, fair.
I think there are films in terms of
Sofia Coppola. Yeah,
Things you've said about everyone else are pretty uncontested. I think Murray's the only of the bunch that there are other films in the running for his
That's fair.
Undoubted, iconic role.
So it really is just that perfect storm of everyone doing their best job, and they got the script, they've got the special effects, they got Ivan Reitman, they've got great 80s music. It's it's awesome. So watch Ghostbusters, for crying out loud.
Yeah, did you think we weren't going to like it?
I mean, really?
Yeah. Actually, I really thought Dan Aykroyd was better in Pearl Harbor. That's going to be a thing that's going to get cut.
Yeah. We're all just looking at you. He actually might have been better in Driving Miss Daisy. I'd give him that.
Actually, I need to watch that.
Yeah.
Wait, who did Aykroyd play in that?
Miss Daisy's son, yeah.
No, I was talking about Pearl Harbor.
The guy that does nothing. the very large man who listens to a radio for about 4 minutes, tells some people some stuff, and then they do nothing to listen to him, and he's like, I told you.
For a second, I thought it was FDR, and I remember, no, it's another white guy that looks actually nothing like FDR.
All right, well, guys, this is not a review show.
No.
We're all thumbs up, but this is an analysis show. So we're going to do some analysis now. We're going to talk about what this movie means. We're going to break it open. We're going to talk about, spoilers alert, there is a marshmallow. It blows up, and other hilarity also.
What did you think? I didn't think about anything. My mind's totally blank.
Ray, what did you do?
Don't tempt me, Dalton. Don't tempt me. All right, Arthur Gordon, if you would, sir, bring us some analysis.
I'm really just going to kind of echo Dalton here. What I really want to key in on is the dialogue of the film. I've always heard that the best writing takes the everyday and amps it up just a bit so that it becomes a caricature of the norm. And I feel like that is really what we get here. The dialogue of the film and the interactions of these characters have this very natural and realistic feeling.
Yeah, it does.
And I'm not talking about the events and the ghosts, of course, but just the banter and the way that they act within situations. It reminds me of how my friends and I joke around just acting situations.
Like when Peter's giving Egon the baby Ruth or whatever it is at Candy Bar.
Crunch Bar.
Was it Crunch Bar? Mm-hmm.
The first example I think of is, you've already quoted it, it's in the ballroom where Stance and Egon are throwing tables over, and then Venkman, in the middle of this crisis... says, hang on, I've always wanted to try this, yanks the tablecloth, trying to rip it from under all the play settings, and, much to the
gin,
the flowers are still standing. And that's where I think this movie really excels. It relies on the actors because they all play their parts and deliver their lines with such a casual move and a nonchalance that just keeps you chuckling through the film.
For sure.
Just the way they just play off so natural, it's brilliant.
They don't make a big deal about the dialogue. Yeah. It's kind of treated as throwaway lines. Yeah. They're some of the most golden lines in the film.
And going back to that ballroom, it's almost off camera, I think, that it happened when you first starts the scene with that act. I also go to the scene where a reporter is doing his thing, and in the background there's this homeless hippie or something walking around in the background. He notices that the camera's on him. And so he kind of starts doing his little thing in the background.
Oh, yeah, the sway. Yeah.
And what I like is this nice balance of we have these kind of very simple things happening in this very over-the-top world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they do this nice balance and blend. And it's perfectly executed through the final sequence at the apartment complex from the interactions of the Busters and Gozers, complete with Ray's ridiculous introduction as a representative of the state, the county, and the city of New York. He's addressing it's as if he's addressing a human being, just another person. There's just such this kind of obliviousness to them that all this ethereal stuff is happening, and it's just every day, just another day on the job.
Then
all the way to the appearance of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, who seemed harmless and reminds us of our childhood. But we get this beautiful balance of the simplicity with
the weirdest face.
And I think this is where a lot of comedies fall apart, because so many times they either focus on trying to get the dialogue and the writing and that writer, they try to go too simple, or they try to be complex or too over the top, or not over the top enough. But this is just such a perfect mixture and balance that I think that's what really sets it up and sets it to be one of the probably the greatest comedies of all time. So
I think that's totally fair.
That's what I got for you this week.
Excellent, excellent. Go get her, Nick.
I think Ghostbusters is going to be a bit of a stretch. If David Fincher were to make a supernatural comedy, I think it would be this, because this film gets right a lot of stuff of what he's kind of known for, which is just creating characters within a space. That's how he views it, all the people in Seven interacting. It's very natural, and it seems like they exist here, and all, you know, Social Network and all that. And it's kind of like this. I mean, obviously, there's not the technical precision that accompanies a Fincher feature, but I think if he were to do, you know, take a crack at a big blockbuster, you know, PG-rated comedy or PG-13, it's kind of that, because it's, you know, like what everyone else is saying. They're very, very natural in their interactions. It seems like, I mean, it seems like they've known each other for years. I mean, because the actors really did, but it just seems very, you know, like that's the focus, is how are these people reacting to everything. That, and I really like kind of the creepy, I mean, there's sort of a creepy atmosphere, you know, kind of in the beginning and kind of peppered
throughout.
That library
scene is brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, there are some genuinely, like, ooh, you know, I mean, it's never, you know, like Exorcist scary or anything, but I do like, I like when genres kind of, you know, kind of crash into each other like that, you know, when Sigourney's lifting off the bed and all that, it reminds me of the Exorcist. And
she sleeps above the covers.
Four feet above her covers. But no, I think that's really, that's it for me.
Excellent.
Love this film to pieces.
I appreciate that. I appreciate also, you know, I mean, everyone has been playing the Fincher rule drinking game at home. Has been so sober for so long.
Oh, yeah.
And thanks for doing that.
I'm not Dalton, so.
Yeah, no, I'm the only one that's ixed for Bowden on that.
So thank you.
David Fincher.
Kiss my black ass.
For all those references.
He really wants to be black.
Mr. Stewart, if you would, sir.
Well, I guess I can. There's something that I thought for a little bit about what I wanted to say about Ghostbusters, and it's something that I keyed on in listening to another conversation about Ghostbusters recently, and I honestly can't remember where. You know what? I do. It was on P. Holmes' podcast, You Made It Weird, and he was talking to Jordan Peele of the sketch show Key & Peele on Comedy Central, and they were talking about how the Ghostbusters are plumbers. And how that idea of them being blue-collar workers really permeates. I mean, they're smoking constantly.
Right.
They've got the jumpsuits. They're in a firehouse. They're blue-collar guys. And I started to think about where they came from, because at the start of the film, they are about as white-collar as you can get. They're in the ivory tower of academia. So I started to kind of think about the division of labor in society.
Uh-oh.
And the you know, the importance we put on certain professions over others, and what we pay certain professions over others, and yet the sort of moral value we give other professions, if that makes sense. So saying a lawyer gets paid more because it's a harder job, but we value a firefighter more from a moral standpoint. From a, you know, you don't see montages of lawyers in front of the American flag, but you see montages of firefighters in front of the American flag.
Well, occasionally when they run for Congress.
My point is, when you look at where we are as a society, we have a very diverse workforce. And Emil Durkheim, one of the early guys in sociology, wrote a lot about this in terms of the solidarity of society and the division of labor. Here, meaning that the further we get along, you know, from prehistoric, moving through, you know, hunter-gatherer, agrarian, the further we go on this timeline, the more diverse the labor force becomes. And he saw this as a good thing, and a lot of his contemporaries did, and it wasn't until a couple decades later that this started to be reevaluated. But he saw this as a good thing because it encouraged what he called organic solidarity, meaning that society and society was very important to Durkheim. And to him, once you got further down the division of labor, there was really less reason to interact with other people. So the solidarity that existed in society exists organically. It formed through an organic need for interaction, or a firefighter needs, you know, a state to pay him.
Right.
The state needs people to pay taxes to pay the firefighter. And this
well,
sort
the
of,
idea that we don't cut our own hair,
exactly.
You know, straighten our own teeth, etc.
But there exists in society this sort of nostalgia for these blue-collar professions that seem to pre-exist all of us. And that's what Durkheim would call, in less advanced societies, less diverse societies in terms of division of labor, a mechanical solidarity, meaning we have no choice but to work together.
Mm-hmm.
The further we get along, we choose to work together, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't cut our own hair, but
right.
We used to.
Yeah.
And we used to have to rely on one another, because if you don't help me, there's a good chance I'm going to starve to death.
Right.
And I think that is, in Ghostbusters, we see this. We see the arc of these characters, which there really isn't one. much to speak of. Nick pointed this out to me.
Peter does not grow as a human being.
None of them do.
That's actually kind of why I love the movie, because there's no change in basically anyone.
And if he's still a Boy Scout.
And if you were to try and find an arc for the characters, I think it would be that they go from, you know, the hallowed halls of academia to being just a couple of working Joes punching the clock. And that's really, yeah.
That was the worst Mexican accent I've ever heard.
I think the best scene is actually Ghostbusters 2 when they're working under the road and then pretend to be working for the phone company.
Yes, yeah. It's hilarious. Yeah. But that's actually a great scene in 2. But that, you know, that is, if there is any arc, it is that.
Yeah.
It is to a more, quote, dignified labor that they're doing. It is a more valued labor by society. They're busting ghosts. They're not sitting in a classroom pondering how they're going to get their next grant.
Can I quibble with you? I think what you're saying is valid, but I do think, especially for Peter's character, there is this idea that the whole thing is, as the dean says, it's a dodge or a hustle, and that, you know, when he starts talking to Ray about why everything happens for a reason. What's the reason?
Money.
There certainly is something a little bit more nefarious, at least in Peter's mind, going.
Oh, sure.
We've got a special going on this week for containment fees.
That's actually one of my favorite parts, because if you look, he looks to Egon, and Egon gives him a sign on how much.
What?
I know. Yeah, Egon
drums on the side of his face for.
No way.
And then does a one high sign on his nose. It's freaking great. But that's a plumber.
That's awesome.
That's a plumber.
Okay. No.
He's gouging your prices.
I like that.
Exactly. There's this weird, like,
we can put it back. Right?
We can. I fixed the leak, but I gotta reattach the pipes if you want to take a crap. So I can leave now, or you can give me another grand, and we'll see what we can do. And that's so—it's so funny to me.
Stop with the Canadian accent. That's how bad it is.
Luigi Mario's in my house. It's so strange.
But that was just something I keyed in on. The more I thought about this film, the more I thought about, at the end of the day, they become guys in jumpsuits smoking cigarettes, and when they start, they're all wearing tweed. And that was kind of what took me down this rabbit hole, thinking about the division of labor.
That's good.
And again, Durkheim thought this was a good thing. And it's funny to look at society and how we really value these tough jobs, these jobs that, again, predate us. That seem to, you know, I can think of a time when that wasn't a new job, but we really value these jobs that I don't remember when that became a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really interesting thing that we do as a society, is put value on blue-collar work. And yet it's something that no one aspires to do.
Yeah, I like that. That is an excellent bit of analysis. I did think sort of this sort of class struggle and
certainly. Is that kind of part of your analysis?
No, I thought about it, and I just hoped somebody would say something. So
you're welcome.
Thank you very much, because I'm going to do something altogether different.
Well, Dustin, what are you going to do?
I'm going to talk a little bit about, now, I think Ghostbusters is a horror film. You know, now Dalton and I had this conversation earlier where he says it's pure comedy.
I maintain that.
And I'm going to say it's a mashup. And I'm going to even say that perhaps...
I'd say the split's 85-15.
That the comedy's engulfing the horror film. But I think the structure, the base core of the film is that of a horror film. And of course, horror films are about dealing with our repressed fears and anxieties. I mean, fundamentally, that's what horror movies are about. And, you know, The Shining is about parenthood and drunkenness and alcoholism and, you know, several other things. And if you watch Room 237, apparently it's about the moon. But we'll talk about that later, dear listener.
It's definitely about spousal abuse.
This movie is about the fear of unrepressed, or rather, open and powerful female sexuality. Is what I want to say that this movie is about.
I'm so glad that's what you're going to talk about.
Just because Sigourney Weaver's in it, that's what you got to. Just because she made another horror film like that, you think it's...
No. Yeah, it's so funny because...
No. Alien's all about rape, but this is about...
This is about
men being afraid of sexually powerful women.
Of sexually liberated women, especially. Huh. And that white men think they want a sexually liberated woman, but as it turns out, no, they actually... don't. Now, we do want to point out the screenplay is written by dudes, but we have Sigourney Weaver's character. She's a professional woman. She's not married. You know, she's living alone. What a crime. And nothing ever happens in the bedroom. and all of these other things that are being said about her. But her first instance with the supernatural is literally ovary eggs exploding, right? I mean, that's what happens. Eggs are blowing up and frying themselves on the counter. This is the beginning of this issue. And, of course, the growth of all the supernatural activities compared to a big Twinkie. That's what she said. And there is, furthermore, this idea that Peter keeps hitting on her. She keeps rebuffing all of his advances, right? Mm. He's going to Miss Barrett's apartment to check her out. I mean, I'm going to go check out Miss Barrett's apartment. He wants her to be available to him sexually. And, of course, she's resisting. And then suddenly he gets what he wants. He gets a little information about her case. They make a date. But then the supernatural takes over, and she's taken over by Gozer. And now she's very much sexually aggressive, and he's freaking her out, right? Because she sleeps 4 feet above her covers. I mean, she could get a guest shot on Wild Kingdom. I could go on. I won't. The problem is that we're very, very fearful of this thing to happen. And so we have this liberated womanhood, and we want that sort of, but actually what we want to do is tame. That's right, Roscoe. We want to tame that libido so that we can go ahead and make that woman, that submissive woman, to us again after we finally, as white men, dominate and have her in this kind of creamy explosion that happens at the end of the film. Because she becomes a dog.
Okay, so she's a dog.
Are you with me?
Yeah. Buddy.
Keep going. And that's really it. I mean, the film climaxes at climax. You know, let's not forget that it's all brought about by this very, very kinky, nimble little minx called Gozer, who happens to be a woman, who happens to be naked, covered in bubble bath bubbles. Mm-hmm. And it's all about taming her. The gentlemen go ahead and do what they don't want. They go ahead and they cross the stream, which is sort of a urine...
Very phallic
reference there. And all of that ends up tying to this idea that they don't actually want Dana to be a dog. We don't want her to be sexually liberated. We thought we did, but really we just want her sexually available in a monogamous relationship with just one guy, Peter, whose name means penis. I'm just saying. The end.
Let us come to your country and put our flag in your ground.
Right.
And buddy, I did not expect you to go there.
Well, it's there.
No, it is, totally. Yeah, I don't think you're reaching that much.
And so
I mean, certainly within the context of the film, he doesn't take advantage of Dana because he realizes she's possessed. But, I mean, you know, looking at it in that larger context, I think it's certainly there.
Thanks for ruining my childhood. my childhood comedic hero is now a rapist in my mind.
Yeah, well, you know,
a sexual deviant.
And I want to say this about this is the second bit of analysis I want to offer. I want to give some sort of consolation to people like poor Nick, whose childhood has now been raped. You can be politically troubled by a movie you like and still like it.
Certainly.
You can see, I mean, again, this is a very, I mean, I would say there's some misogyny going on in this film.
Yeah.
Yet.
1984.
Yet, this movie is tons of fun. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. And it's misogynistic. And I realize that. I don't like misogyny, but I like Ghostbusters. And I don't see that there's any problem having that. And not everything you watch needs to be politically, ideologically, philosophically, theologically lined up with whatever, you know, particular check marks you tick off on the census.
I don't like
Teen Wolf.
I don't like racism, but I also hate Teen Wolf. I was going to say, but I like American History X, but then I realize it's actually a bad example.
Yes, it is. So, there we go. I think that's
dug that analysis, buddy. I'm honest with you. That was a good one.
So there's some more conversation to have, I think, with all of you, dear listeners. What do you think about what we're saying about Ghostbusters? What do you think about Ghostbusters? What readings would you provide of the film? Is it a horror movie or not?
Is it a comedy?
Let the cage match begin.
I'm right. Clearly.
I think it's a horror cake with comedy frosting.
I think that's actually exactly what I think. So, Nick, you're correct.
You're both idiots.
Dear listener, let us know what you think about that. We can do that in social media. One of those mediums of social media is got a blue logo with the letter F on it, right? What's that all about?
I think it's called Facebook, and you can find it on the internet at worldwideweb.facebook.com/goodtrashgenrecast, one word.
Do we have any feedback from the Facebook?
We got a couple little bites. We got a little couple nibbles. As far as last week's game of effective horror films, Randall Bays chimed in with The Cell. saying that's one that you should pay attention to?
I've not seen.
And
I've actually heard that's a really good one. Again, this was effective horror films that you don't remember.
Yeah, or
that don't stick in the popular conscience.
Yeah, no.
Conscious.
And he said, well, Army of Darkness is a great flick to watch with people.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of had that...
right. That kind of one you could not pay attention to in that movie. Sorry.
You should pay attention.
And then
there's a lot going on in that movie.
I asked the other question of people's thoughts on Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm.
Randall. Randall reminds us that Bill Murray is a god. Brigham says it is infinitely
quotable.
And if
anyone asks you if you were a god, you say yes.
Brigham says it is infinitely quotable and hilarious through and through. And while our dear own Mr. Sanford here says it is his favorite comedy ever. So that's what I got from the face of Facebook.
Excellent, excellent. Let's keep that conversation going there. I posted a couple little links. There's a survey on their question about identifying science fiction spaceships. A double dog dare to give that one a shot, dear listener, because it's harder than it looks. Dalton, there's yet another medium. Do you have anything you'd like to say?
Dustin.
Dalton.
I want you to do me a favor. Try to imagine all life as you know it, stopping instantaneously and every molecule in your body exploding at the speed of light.
Total photonic reversal?
That's what happens when you subtweet people. Ladies and gentlemen, the Good Trash Genre Cast can be found on Twitter at good_trash.
Any feedback from there?
Not really this week, although I will say this. Brigham Cole, as he always does, tweeted us a really interesting article from the people at crack.com about why every movie plot follows weirdly specific rules. That was a fun article, and that led me to another one about how movies with great plots were really stupid, and like why there was a much easier out than going through the entire monotony of the plot.
Like
Django Unchained.
Yeah.
Or he could have just gone by himself and bought Broomhilda, and that would have been the end of it.
Yeah.
Things like that. Really, and that wasn't what he linked me to, but I ended up going there, and I had a blast with that, so... That's really it. We didn't really have much going on Twitter this week.
Hey, guys, we want to keep this conversation going. I mean, this is just a bunch of guys talking about movies. We want to have the conversation with you all out there, dear listener, guys and gals. I think I use guys in the original Greek tense, which is gender neutral, just so you know.
Sir, the last thing, for those of you who are not on social media of any sort, we can now be reached via email at goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com.
So yeah, if you got something really long-winded you'd like to say to us, please send it.
Now you have no excuse not to talk to us.
Yeah.
Shoot us a link.
Oh, but I'm not on Facebook. I'm not either.
And we're also goodtrashgenrecast.tumblr.com. We want to talk to you so bad. We are extending our tendrils.
We will go door to door with the Jehovah's Witnesses to get your opinion.
I will say, Dustin does a heck of a job with Tumblr. Every time I happen to look at it, there's something really fun on there related to the movie we're going to be talking about. I get a kick out of it.
So we want to keep that going, and again, just keep the conversation going, because that's really what matters when we're talking about this sort of stuff. That's great. We want to keep the conversation going on social media, but first we need to do what we always do. We need to talk about this movie, Shelf or Trash, and then I think the more interesting conversation.
Else or instead.
Mr. Arthur Gordon, if you would, sir.
Definitely, it's already on the shelf.
Right.
Great movie. A near perfect comedy. Else, I'm going to watch this with another well-written and well-acted comedy. Dalton's already talked about it. Clue. A great ensemble piece. Great comedy.
Really great companion.
I wish this was video, because all hands went in the air and went, of course.
I killed Yvette. I hated her so much. Flames on the side of my face.
Fun fact. Almost every single one of Murray's lines in Ghostbusters ad-libbed. The only bit of ad-libbing in Clue is Madeline Kahn's bit right there.
Awesome.
Everything else is so tightly scripted in that movie.
Mm-hmm. And then, this is going to be a marathon, three movies. We're going to finish it off with a more recent wonder, Zombieland, and we still have some tie-in with Ghostbusters,
very
of course.
Good pick.
And
very
so
good
I think
pick.
That would be a fun evening of comedy
I think it's great
films
pick.
Watching.
Excellent, excellent. Mr. Nick Sanford, Shelf or Trash? Else or instead?
Shelf. In fact, I've got a framed poster of it at my house. That's how shelfy.
Excellent. Excellent. Welcome,
or
comrade.
Or a shrine. Else, I have thought of this zero. I would either say Dr. Strangelove because it's another good ensemble comedy, or Bruce Almighty because it's a good comedy with fantastical elements that takes place in New York.
I like
pick.
Those picks.
Either one of those.
A lot, Nick
Sanford. Good pick.
Mr. Dalton Stewart, what say you?
Well, you know, Dustin, I thought a lot about something that subverts the horror genre in some way, right? And takes a horror genre and puts it in an environment that we're infinitely familiar with, and yet it's easy for us to not fully understand. So with Ghostbusters, we have, you know, this idea of paranormal phenomenon being put into the everyday lives of plumbers or, you know, any other blue-collar worker. And then what I landed on was a little television series called Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, did you?
I did.
That's a shocker.
Yeah. Mostly to piss you off, but also because it really does. It does something very similar.
It's so meh.
It's a horror comedy that takes the supernatural elements and puts it in an environment that we're all familiar with, and yet as we get older, it's very easy to forget what it's like. You made a face when I said horror comedy.
It was like, I feel like I just won, but I don't think I really won. Because you confessed that Ghostbusters was also a horror comedy.
Oh, it's a horror comedy, but it's a horror comedy.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah, it's like it's an 85-15 split.
I want to debate that Buffy is a horror comedy, but continue.
That's it. I'm not going to debate that with you. No. You know I'm right. No. The listeners know I'm right because you're the only person that doesn't like Buffy. Moving on.
Okay.
Well, I guess it's Dustin? Time.
Well, clearly, Shell. I mean, there's no...
Justin, for your pick, yeah.
My pick would be this. I want to give you a little bit of film theory and actor strategy. Mm-hmm. Particular actor, look at the last 30 years or so of top grossing box office films. Okay. And saw that many of them were both special effects features, mm-hmm. and comedy. And realized this was the key to making it as a big-time actor to make a ton of money. He had another career. He'd begun in music, mm-hmm. got a little spot in television, and so Will Smith made a movie called Men in Black based on his research, and that's why that movie worked so well and why it made so much stinking money. And I would say Men in Black would be a great companion piece.
It certainly is.
I said that on
Tuesday.
Talked
about this. Yeah. Me and Nick talked about this as a companion piece to this film. Yeah. They are certainly of birds of a feather, to be sure.
And it's a little bit of a fun fact of just Will Smith's research and why he chooses some of the projects he chooses.
Star Wars.
Yeah. Wait, that's a real thing?
Like, that's a real thing. He really does that.
That's why he gravitates to sci-fi so much, is because of Star Wars. Like Independence Day and whatever other sci-fi movies.
He knew it'd make money.
Wow.
Huh.
The more you know.
There you go. Well, hey, let's play our game. Dalton, can you tee that up?
I will tee it up. So we talked a little bit about it. Not a lot. But we talked a little bit about it. And obviously, Ghostbusters 3 has been in developmental hell for years. And it's been in developmental hell for so long. They're actually talking about doing kind of a quasi-sequel reboot. But we don't want to talk about that. We thought about doing like...
There is a link about that on the Facey Facebook.
There is. We thought about who we'd like to see, you know, be the new generation of Ghostbusters. But instead, we really wanted to key on. We've been doing a lot of movie lists lately, and we decided to keep that going. We're going to talk about our favorite ensemble comedies, because honestly, we couldn't believe we hadn't talked about it yet.
Yeah.
So I think this week, we're going to really kind of talk about what makes an ensemble comedy great, and what are some great examples of that.
Mm-hmm. With that in mind, Mr. Nick Sanford, if you'd start, sir.
Yeah, me. I was going to say Dr. Strangelove for this, but I'm going to go with all of... Very much less obvious choice, much less. The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, also starring Bill Murray. That's actually probably my second favorite comedy. Weirdly, I know it gets kind of a weird. I mean, it kind of has a weird reputation, but it's a big ensemble. It's got Kate Blanchett, Owen Wilson. I mean, you can look it up online, but. I don't know. I think that's...
That's a good pick,
I think that's a strong...
It's a blind spot for me in terms of Wes Anderson, but...
Oh, yeah, you haven't seen it yet.
I have not, it. No.
But, it was also the first Wes Anderson film I ever saw, but...
And as they say, your first Wes Anderson's your favorite.
Yeah.
You have me and Wes Anderson.
I like that pick, sir. Excellent. Mr. Dalton Stewart, what's your pick?
I actually wrote down every Wes Anderson movie. Because every Wes Anderson movie is a solid ensemble comedy featuring Bill Murray. Except for Bottle Rocket.
We should just pick Bill Murray films to talk about.
Sure, not right? Kind of. Because Bill Murray's awesome.
He is.
Bill Murray.
Jinxing everybody.
So if I were to pick a Wes Anderson film, I would probably honestly hew towards his most recent outing. Moonrise Kingdom. Thank you. I blanked out for a second. Because I love Bill Murray in that. I think it's a great performance for him. Mm-hmm. That's a really touching and powerful film. I also Rushmore, obviously. Again, every Wes Anderson movie is a solid ensemble comedy. So I started thinking about, all right, what else can we talk about? And it popped in my brain for almost with no prodding, Burn After Reading from the Coen brothers, you know, a return to some of their screwball comedy that they did earlier in their career, 2010, 2009, I want to say.
Eight.
Thank you, Nick.
September 2008.
It's always great to have somebody with Asperger's on the show. Right. But it's a great film. It's really funny. Again, a really kind of wacky screwball comedy. And I think that's, with an ensemble comedy, I think that's something that a lot of people go towards, is kind of emulating that screwball style from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. I thought about Some Like It Hot, but that's not really an ensemble. It's really kind of a two-guy movie.
Yeah,
but
it's wonderful though.
It is great. It is great, and that's why I thought about it. But that's what took me to Burn After Reading was this idea of screwball comedies, which I think ensembles are really conducive to, because you can get a lot of people together, and give them a lot of different characters, and just really have a lot of fun. Another film I thought about was Tropic Thunder from 2008, an obvious choice. I mean, for sure, a lot of fun, a huge a skewering of Hollywood if there ever was one. A film that I love immensely. With a great cast, had a lot of fun. And one final that I just thought about as we were talking in terms of special effects, and is what made me think of it. Nick was talking about special effects. And this is The End from this last year.
Yeah.
A really a fun film. A lot of fun. It's funny. Go see it. It's got special effects. That's what made me think of it.
But fits the category.
It's really, Nick mentioned, that doesn't get made very often. You don't see a comedy that is also spectacle very often. And This Is the End certainly applies in that category. Very funny. And I always enjoy actors playing themselves and having a little fun with their public persona. I think that's very interesting.
Excellent. Excellent.
I think my first pick is going to be The Fighter. Great ensemble comedy.
It's heartwarming.
I'm going to go a little more commercial.
Isn't that your face?
My first choice, or choices, I think they go together, are the Oceans films. The match, we got the heist film, but we've got a lot of comedy there too. I think we have
I got a question. Have you seen the Frankie Sinatra ones?
No.
Okay. They're wonderful too.
Are they?
The one is. Yeah.
Frank's still making them?
No, Frank's dead. What? Frank Sinatra's been dead for 10 years.
But I think the cast in the Oceans films, they have great chemistry, and the additions over the course of the trilogy, they all fit in really well. The other one, I'm not a huge Will Ferrell fan as a lead actor. I don't like really any of his movies outside of a couple. But I would say Anchorman.
Great.
And I think, other than Elf, this is one that I really enjoy watching. I think there are some fun performances here from Steve Carell and Paul Rudd. I think this kind of
boosted David Paul Rudd's everyone. Career.
And then the fun, we got some great cameos here, Ben Stiller and Vince Vaughn, and it's...
Tim Robbins.
Yeah. This is a
public blast. Access news is here.
That whole sequence is so weird, and surreal and amazing.
It's just awesome.
They go to get new suits and have a news team rumble. It's the best. More do you want?
Hey guys, Brick killed a guy.
Was that a trend? Yeah, I stabbed a man in the heart.
Brick, I've been meaning to talk to you about that. But those are my picks for ensemble comedies.
Excellent.
Good picks, Arthur.
You know, Arthur made a snarky comment. I was going to say Magnolia was my favorite ensemble comedy. Aww. But but now I don't
get it. Well, Dustin, what are your real picks?
My real pick, I have one pick because it really is one other movie that kind of eclipses all others. It's an ensemble piece, and that is City Slickers. John Lovitz, Billy Crystal, Daniel Stern, Jack Palance, several other character actors making little bits and pieces here and there, and it is so quotable. Again, it is so fun. It's got that formula that you see in Ghostbusters, where we have great stand-up comics, great improv comics doing what they do. Also, a great classic Hollywood actor playing just crazy himself. You know, hey, Curly, kill anyone today, day ain't over yet. He wins the Academy Award, does push-ups on the stage at 80. It's a great movie, and you should see City Slickers. It's one of my favorites of all time.
Good pick.
So, great. Mr. Arthur Gordon, what say you, sir?
This is just going to random take us back to Ghostbusters thing.
Yeah.
Did I see Eddie Winslow, or Papa Winslow, in Ghostbusters as the cop that
comes
by?
He's a jailer.
Okay.
No.
I thought it was him.
Carl Winslow.
Carl, thank you.
That's the same cop. in Die Hard.
Yeah.
As in Family Matters, as in Ghostbusters.
Okay.
He's the same cop in all
plays
of them.
A cop.
He's just
the
same character.
Same character.
He's
actually a cop in
he
life
just moved,
and hired him.
He just moved to Los Angeles, and that's where Family Matters started.
He keeps wondering why he's showing
Hard.
Up in all these movies. They just show up with camera. He's like, what are you guys doing? What,
I'm trying to do my job here. And then for 9 seasons, he had to hang
so
around.
So Family Matters was the first
Steve
reality show.
Why? Okay.
Family Matters was a reality show.
Oh, yeah. About, you know, struggling police officer Carl Winslow and his sociopathic neighbor, Jaleel White.
Can I do that?
Stefan or Kel.
Stefan.
All right. That was some serious shark jumping.
I'm going to pull everything back.
No.
We're going to now move on to what we always do as we conclude the show.
Is it that time?
It is that time to talk about what's got us fired up this week in pop culture. I begin with Mr. Arthur Gordon, sir.
Oh, wow. You just put me on the spot. All right. So
I was
right
here.
Go. Criterion, 50% off sale at Barnes & Noble right now.
Oh, wow. Do that.
So if you're looking for some art house films or some... Why did they put this out on Art House DVD films? you go check those out. There's some good stuff out there. Apparently, they released an extended edition of The Hobbit with 13 extra minutes of footage, which seemed a bit redundant to me.
Yeah, that was 13 minutes was all because
they'd already
shot the other 45 minutes in the theatrical cut.
They need that money, though. They're going broke out there. Man of Steel hits DVD next week. I'm interested to pick that up.
Underrated.
12 Years a Slave opens this week in OKC metro area.
Woo!
I believe Quail Springs, maybe the Warrens are going to be getting it, so that's a definitely,
really? Oh,
definitely
wow.
One worth checking out, I think.
I think I know what I'm doing this week.
Probably the early front runner for some major awards
certainly,
this fall.
Certainly. And Steve McQueen deserves them. That guy's a heck of a filmmaker.
Yeah. The last thing, I saw this today, Coming Soon reported that the Walt Disney Company and Netflix have announced the deal to bring 4 live-action Marvel shows to Netflix starting in 2015. This will lead to a miniseries. The characters making their way to Netflix include Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Iron Fist, and Luke Cage. There will be several years of programming focusing on the heroes and villains of Hell's Kitchen. Netflix is committed to 4 13-episode series, which will lead up to Marvel's The Defenders, a miniseries that reimagines the heroic team. The show will be produced by Marvel Television in association with ABC Television.
See, Dustin
Studios.
Rolls his eyes. But I know why.
Tell him why. Tell him why I'm rolling my eyes.
Dustin's rolling his eyes because, as we talked about all summer, we've got a little superhero fatigue. But I'm going to tell you why this is awesome. This is awesome because I think Marvel and Disney have cracked the code on this. They've figured out how this is going to work and how this should work. And how this should work is doing something different and bringing superheroes to television, one, and not in a craptastic way like Smallville. And really, again, playing with the format that they pioneered with the Avengers and doing something with heroes that are important to Marvel fans, but really aren't big enough for a movie. So what are we going to do? We're going to put them on a television show. I think Daredevil is such an untapped resource.
Yeah.
He really is. If you guys haven't checked out this sizzle reel that Joe Carnahan did for his proposed Marvel film, Daredevil film, before the rights reverted to Marvel, you really should. It's some interesting stuff. I think this is a really cool idea. Basically, the TV version of the Avengers.
Yeah.
And Netflix has the budget. Yeah. Unlike, I think they've got a little cash to spread around.
Yeah.
I think they can do something interesting with this.
So.
And Luke Cage and Iron Fist are two heroes that people have been really wanting to see.
Cool. Yeah.
Brought to live action for a while.
And you know what? I plan to go hopefully see Thor once we're done recording here.
Oh, you're going
to
go right now?
Well, in a couple hours. But, you know what?
Let me know how it is.
Justin, you can be a commercial all you want.
I hear it's better than the first one. So.
It really wouldn't take much. Because
no,
the first film really only succeeded in Asgard.
It's only slightly better than Iron Man 2.
Yeah.
But, you know, as long as the Marvel films keep being good, I'm going to keep going.
Yeah, I've got my money for a while.
I think Marvel Studios has really figured out how to make good films. I honestly do. I get why people are tired of seeing them. Mm-hmm. And I'm not quite as excited about them. I'm not as excited about them. Again, Dustin and Arthur and Nick are doing some weird solidarity of people who are shitheads and don't like to have any fun right now. I get what
no, I like fun. Having different types of fun.
And
I feel like I've been watching the same.
Yeah,
thing
I want the Avengers
and I agree, and I certainly get that fatigue. But I don't think there's anything wrong. I think the problem is with people trying to copy the format, not this format in and of itself. I think Marvel Studios has figured something out. I think everyone else who owns a Marvel license, that being Sony, should stop.
Well, 20th Century Fox, you're really excited about X-Men First Class. I just beat you at your own game. Door's right there.
that was so ninja.
Days of Future Past. And yeah, he's right. Okay, fair enough. My point is,
wow, dear listener, I'm going to make that a ringtone on my phone.
If the work is quality, is quality. I do agree that I would like some more variety.
Yeah.
Variety is the spice of life. I certainly think we shouldn't be seeing the same thing every day.
Yeah.
But I don't see any reason that means we should not make this.
Yeah.
So, I think that's exciting news, Arthur.
That's all. There we go. That's my paragraph name. Go, somebody.
Mr. Nick Sanford, if you would, sir. What's got you fired up this week in pop culture?
Two things. within the last week, the new Wolf of Wall Street trailer was released, and that I downloaded all two songs that were used in that.
Is this your car outside?
Yeah.
How much do you make?
$72,000 last month.
You show me a pay stub of $70,000, I quit my job right now.
Yeah, hello? Yeah, it's me. I quit.
But
great trailer.
Yeah, that trailer. I'm not even going to talk about the movie because obviously that's a month and a half off. But I watched that trailer so freaking much. The other legitimate thing that has got me fired up is the three James Dean films were released on Blu-ray from Warner Brothers on Tuesday.
Fantastic.
I picked up Rebel Without a Cause yesterday.
As you should have.
And it looks amazing. They also, all three are packaged in like one of the big deluxe Warner Brothers collector edition things. I'm not gay enough for James Dean that much, so I'm going to buy that. But I really like Rebel Without a Cause, and I'm probably going to pick up East of Eden at some point as well. But Rebel looks amazing, and it's got this really cool packaging that has everything in black and white, so anyone who hasn't seen the movie is going to be like, oh, it's black and white, and then pop it in, and it's all vivid and bright and stuff like that.
But and where did you pick this treasure up at?
I got it at Vintage Stock. That was the only place I could find it. I went into Best Buy, and as I do whenever I go into Best Buy and I can't find something I want, I go right next door to Vintage Stock, and they had it.
Nice.
And it's a lovely package, and it looks terrific. Even the nighttime outdoor scenes look amazing.
Excellent. Dalton, are you fired up this week?
Believe it or not, until about yesterday, I was not. I had nothing for today.
Really?
Not a damn thing. And then I went to a little website that comes up on the show from time to time,
TheEscape.com.
Yes, okay. And I was unable
to get on
to register for my socialist healthcare.
That is not socialist healthcare.
Oh, that was the joke.
Moving on.
That was the joke.
Politics.
Thank you, Arthur. No, what I did was I went to a little website that comes up on here from time to time, theescapistmagazine.com. And Escapist, as has been mentioned, has this web series from a guy called Movie Bob. He does a film review show.
I've heard of Movie Bob.
But he also does another thing called The Big Picture, which is just very kind of just nerd culture centric and whatever's on his mind. And he did something that I think all of our listeners should watch. And it's an episode about the nature of film criticism, or game, any criticism. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever thought to yourself, why the shit are these guys watching Ghostbusters and then talking about the division of labor and the sexuality of women? Then you should probably watch this episode of this show because it really explains what criticism is about.
Mm-hmm.
And it explains the nature of criticism and the history of criticism. It's a very, very interesting little 6-minute video that kind of explains the genesis of this thing that we do on this show. And I was really excited watching it, thinking to myself, oh, hey, that's what we do. And in case you're wondering, in terms of chicken and the egg, the type of criticism we do came first, if
right.
you weren't aware. The sort of consumer, which refrigerator do I like best? Brands of refrigerators. But that for movies came later.
Just how to buy tickets kind of, yeah,
exactly.
Review shows.
How do I buy tickets? And that came with the middle class, as many awesome things do. But it was it's a very interesting little video that I strongly recommend you check out if you've ever thought to yourself, what's this whole criticism thing about? I don't get it. He's a very smart guy that I think could probably explain this to you a little bit better than I can. And really, that's it. Dustin, Let's get you fired up this week.
I got a couple things that got me fired up. One of those things, I was sent a link by listener Ashley Rains on Facebook about
awesome.
The new ratings requirement for films in Sweden.
Really?
That films for theatrical release in Sweden must now pass the Bechdel test.
What's the... That Bechdel test.
The Bechdel test, in which there are more than one female character, in which there is a conversation between those two female characters, where they do not talk about having a relationship with a man.
And it has to be X amount of time.
2 minutes long.
Yeah.
And so, I think it's a little crazy.
So they'll give out citizens handguns, but they don't...
It's because they don't have a standing army.
You're thinking Switzerland.
I'm an idiot.
If it doesn't pass the Bechdel test, it doesn't get certified?
It doesn't get a certification, doesn't get a theatrical release, it doesn't get a rating. Guardian's got an article on it. It's on the Facey Facebook.
That's a real thing?
That's a thing.
Holy crap.
This is what I think about...
That's awesome yet extreme.
Yeah, it is. And you know what's great about the Hays Code and other forms of censorship is they are these great founts of creativity. To get around them.
Yes.
And that's what I'm excited to see. I'm also curious to see if we will start getting Swedish cuts with the additional scenes of films just so that they can pass said Bechdel test.
Kind of like how Iron Man went to China and told China how great they were.
Correct. I'm thinking perhaps something like that. And I hope it's not so ham-fisted and whatnot, but I don't know. The other thing that's going to be fired in pop culture actually ties to a bit of conversation that we were having just a few moments ago, and also ties to a conversation that I had with occasional co-host Caleb Masters at lunch today. And we were talking about...
Why didn't you have lunch with me?
You didn't ask. He did.
Fair enough.
You know?
There it is.
Anyway, this idea of what Nick was saying earlier about how I like these big, fun, dumb comic book movies. I do. But I like other stuff as well.
Totally fair.
I like to see... And this everyone is talking about the total failure of this tentpole model that Hollywood keeps turning out. Yet they keep churning it out. This week, Ender's Game came out, which I have not yet seen. I hear it's okay. I hear it's fun. I hear people who like the book are dumb. Those things are what they are.
I just really don't care.
Well, I don't either. But it's not going to make a sequel now because
didn't make enough money.
Not enough money because there's too much stinking money thrown into it to make it in the first place. I want to give you a year, dear listener.
Give me a year, Dustin.
1988.
What happened in 1988?
Was you it know, Batman
it was
happened.
89. It was June of 89. Well,
what did I say? 98. I meant 89. He said 89.
You said 88.
I said 88. Okay. Batman came out in 88.
89.
Did it?
Yep.
Are we sure about
Believe me, he's sure.
It came out about 5 days before I was born.
Okay.
Dustin, look at me. He's sure.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I just want to talk
There's
about...
a tattoo.
Well, I was going to say that there was a big dumb comic book movie in that year. I'm prepared for 1988, so forgive my slight faux pas there.
So are we fast-forwarding to 1989 now?
No, I'm sticking with 88. Because, okay. You know, in 88, there's a lot of... I'll give you a big budget movie.
Okay.
That was special effects heavy and lots of fun. Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
You're going to say that.
And tons of fun. Also a movie called Beetlejuice. Also a movie called Rain Man. Also a movie called Die Hard. Also a movie called Big. Fish Called Wanda. Coming to America.
I'm sorry, when you said Die Hard, did you mean to say the greatest film ever made by Americans?
Bull Durham was made that year. So was Willow. Child's Play was made that year. Also a Steven Seagal movie, Above the Law. What I'm saying is this.
Above the Law is a fantastic film.
It's a ton of fun. Lots of movies were being made. These movies made money. They made their money back because there are lots of movies being made. There were all kinds of movies. And there wasn't just this one, you know, big event to next big event to next big event model. And I want to suggest, dear listeners in Hollywood, I know there's so many of you, that... maybe something more like what was going on in the late 80s might work out. Yes, every once in a while something crazy happens and you make stupid money, you know, on a movie like The Avengers, on a movie like Batman. But that being said, you can't be counting on that as your financial model. You've got
Certainly.
To diversify your investment. Something
yeah,
more...
you guys are hedge fund managers. You should understand that.
Diversify. Do something more like the studio system where you've got a slate of movies being made. And you're making tons of movies. You know, the great thing about the 40s and the 50s was that, yeah, there
was... that black people knew their place.
Incorrect. What was great about the 40s and the 50s was that these great subversive movies about how black people actually were human beings. I'm looking at you, the searchers. and other films were being made because it was just another Western in the schedule.
Yep.
And sure, there was some tripe that was coming out there, but there was stuff like The Searchers. There were huge movies
coming
out.
But you could trick the bigwigs into giving you money to make something subversive and interesting.
And the Ben-Hurs were coming out. The film noirs were coming out. The genre churn mills were coming out. And then sure, there was a lot of kind of just run-of-the-mill stuff, but then there was beautiful stuff coming out, like The Maltese Falcon. And what I want to say is there is an opportunity that is being missed right now in that you are not diversifying the portfolio. Really, the only place where there's low-budget kind of edgy movies being made are independent films that are either these boutique dramas or horror films. And there's something really, really broken in that system.
So, yeah, even the independent system is broken. It's a coming-of-age story or a gore fest.
Yeah,
and with no in-between.
Maybe
you get both.
Yeah, maybe. So I just want to say we've got to find some place in the middle. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff broken in the studio system and the way actors were treated, the way non-union workers were treated.
Certainly.
All of that. There's a lot broken
certainly
in that. But I think somewhere in the middle of that is something that makes sense, that has justice for the workers.
Compromise.
And good movies and quality and Hollywood making their money so that my favorite art form continues in some recognizable form to what we have today.
What blows my mind is, because I agree with everything you're saying, what blows my mind is every once in a while a movie will break out a really kind of tonally different, like Django, that's my most recent example. It made close to $200 million, and they're still not looking at that saying, if we give them something different, maybe they'll get excited and go see it a lot.
Right?
Well, you go back a few years and you look at True Grit, The Artist, three or four of the movies that year, all passed or hit $100 million.
Yeah.
Very different
films. All, yeah.
And they got lucky on that, but Hollywood writes that off as somehow
the fluke.
Instead of saying, no, the fluke is that you make $1 billion on Avengers.
That you convince people to see five movies to see one movie.
Yeah,
like,
that's a fluke.
And again, and I
spent $300 million on The Lone Ranger.
To play
shocked that you lose your money.
To play devil's advocate, though, I think it's an interesting time. At the same time, we're getting this lack of diversity that we really desperately need. There is also something interesting happening in the tentpole franchise, in that Paramount and Marvel Studios and now Disney trusted people to do homework. To go see or rent five movies to see one movie and then watch a TV series. Like, it's weird. And again, I'm not saying this is all good, but I think there's certainly something interesting here.
Yeah.
And where we're trusting audiences with continuity.
Yeah.
In a weird way that we haven't done with mainstream entertainment.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of interesting. I think it's kind of cool.
I mean, I agree.
I think there's something nifty about that. I don't think it's all roses and sunshine.
I'm somewhat frustrated, but intrigued that the fact that the Infinity Gauntlet series is not going to happen for Avengers 2, that's actually slated for Avengers 3.
Yeah.
I mean, that's intriguing to me because we tipped that hand with the first Avengers film. And so that is interesting that they're doing that, but I have to say, I'm not convinced the wisdom.
You know what my favorite thing about Marvel movies is?
That
James Gunn got to make another movie.
That's a good reason.
Well, I guess that's it.
That is it. That's a show, dear listener. We're so glad that you stayed in and kept the conversation going with us. We want to talk with you more about Ghostbusters. We also want to talk to you a little bit about next week's film, which is starring the chin of Carl Urban.
And speaking of comic book movies.
And speaking of comic books, there are comic strips. So there's books. There are books.
There's books and collections and series and serials.
And what have you.
We're going to look at a little film that I talked about very, 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 very early. I want to say the second episode.
Yeah,
you
saw the theatres.
I remember talking about it when it was in the lead up to its release, and I saw it in the theater. We're going to talk about one of the most underrated films of 2012, and that is Dread. A film that nobody saw, and everyone should have, because it's freaking great.
I'm excited to see this movie, and I'm excited to keep talking with you all about that movie. We want to keep the conversation going.
That was a deep cut, though. That was a deep, good trash cut.
That is a deep cut, yeah.
Was the Carl Urban chin joke.
Yeah, that was way back then, just like Angelina Jolie's leg. Now, let's talk about how we can have the conversation continue on Twitter. Where are you at, Arthur?
You can find me at RNDTBLReview, as in Roundtable Review.
Mr. Sanford, where are you at, sir?
Nick_Sanford on the Twitter, and also, if I may plug shamelessly, on Facebook.com/BroadcastPictures, I've got a trailer for a film, a mockumentary I'm making called Elusive, which I got the idea from watching Ghostbusters a couple years ago. It's a horror,
excellent.
Horror comedy, kind of supernatural. It's about Bigfoot.
I love it. I love it. And Nick is a filmmaker. Tempest Fugit is coming, dear listener. There will be news about that in the future as well.
Yes.
I will shamelessly whore for you if you will not do it for yourself.
Thank you.
Mr. Dalton Stewart.
My name is Dalton Stewart, and you can find me on Twitter.
Yes.
No introduction.
Someone's been drinking too much lemonade, I think. It's getting a little goofy.
It's the end of the show, not the start of the show. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find me on Twitter at @Dal_Stew, as in a hearty dish made out of plastic things you give to your children. And because Nick didn't do it himself, and because I know this episode will probably be up before this night's over or tomorrow afternoon, Nick Sanford will be performing at McSalty's in Oklahoma City on Friday, November the 7th?
8th.
8th. Which will be...
Also November 15th, the next Friday.
So there's a good chance you've already listened to this and you're like, oh, it's not November 8th. Well, November 15th, we'll be doing stand-up there again.
Hey, you can find me on Twitter at @Dustin_Sells. And I'd like to keep the conversation going with you all, and all of us would. See us on the Facebook, see us on the Tumblr, see us on the Twitter. We want to keep talking with you. And you know, guys, I think the show did okay.
Yeah.
What do you think, Peter?
We came, we saw, we kicked its ass. Something strange.